3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognize their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You're on the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR with Hannah and Rob.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So good to have both of us back in the studio.
Yay.
You've come back from a month in Umbuntu.
Mm-hmm.
How was that?
It was amazing. It was really beautiful and powerful and just, yeah, it was great. I want to move to Alice Springs now. And last week's episode was all about my adventures.
Yay.
So if you missed me, tune into last week's episode.
Yeah, I bet it would have been really powerful to be there.
Yeah, it really was.
Did you get to look at the stars at night?
Yes, like yes. Every night for a month. It was beautiful.
Ugh, so nice.
I saw the dark emu for the first time. Never Whoa. Seen it before. Yeah.
The stars. That's so cool.
Very cool.
How was your weekend?
It was good. Got a lot of people staying at my house who went on the art tour, so that's been fun to like help us reintegrate back into Nam. Yeah. Don't even remember the weekend.
It was really nice on Saturday, the weather.
Yeah, it was so sunny.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
I sat in the dog park and read my book.
Oh yeah,
for like that's an hour.
Nice. Yeah.
Because I went to, you know, there's a library at Kynes. You know Kynes, the cafe in Brunswick. Anyway, it's a cafe literally on my street in Brunswick. And they have an anti-colonial library there that you can join for free.
Yes, I have seen. Yeah.
And I borrowed a book there, Feminism Abolition Now.
Yeah.
I think borrowing political books from a library is so cool. Borrowing books from a library in general, so cool. But I really like borrowing political books from the library because it gives, like, I have to return it. Do you know what I mean? So, I have to sit down.
You have to finish it.
And finish it and read it.
Yeah.
And I'm really enjoying it. But I kind of, I don't know, crazy to admit that I like the deadline.
No, I need a deadline. I went to Nibs, actually.
Yes.
In Trades Hall.
Yes.
And I got some good political
sponsor
books there
of
too.
The breakfast shows.
Yeah, shout out Nibs.
Shout out Nibs. And did you buy a nice book?
I did. I bought Angela Davis's autobiography.
Amazing.
I'm really excited to
read it. She wrote part of the book I'm reading, Feminism Abolition Now.
She's amazing.
Yeah, there's a really cool part in there about a prison that they built in the middle of New York in the 30s, a women's prison. And they had to, like, basically close it down. Like, they built a new prison that was just outside of the city because, like, people could literally just walk up in the middle of the street and just, like, scream into the window.
Yeah.
And so, like, they were able to, like, people on the outside were able to create a bail fund and literally directly communicate with the prisoners. Just literally, like, imagine, like, you're walking down Smith Street and you can just go, like, oh, just go talk to the prisoners and see if they need anything. So they organize a bail fund on the outside, and then the women on the inside would vote as to who needed the bail the most.
Wow.
This is in the 30s. And they eventually, I think by the 50s or something, they had to relocate all the women. Partially, I think, because it was too much of a problem that people, like, literally people could organize against the prison system in and out of it just by, like, walking up onto the street.
That's so good.
Like, you didn't even need to book an appointment, or you could just be, like, screaming. Let's quickly talk about what's coming up on the show, hey?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to start off the show by hearing a conversation that I had. A conversation is kind of loose. It's an interview that I did with the Seahorse Collective, who are an anonymous, autonomous collective of trans and gender diverse people who are supporting other people in the community struggling to access gender affirming care. So that's happening first up, and that'll probably take us all the way through to around 7:30, 7:45-ish. And then following that, we'll be playing part of an interview from Billabong Beats, I believe, from 2 weeks ago, in which host Gavin Moore speaks with Marilyn and Peter from Friends of the Naya Vinifera Park campaign. And it's a very beautiful conversation talking about water sovereignty in the Murray River. So we've got a few parts of that to play as well. And the show is going to end with an interview with someone from 44 Flats United. We're going to be talking about their action coming up on Wednesday at the Housing Minister's Office. And yeah, always interested to get their perspective on living in the flats that are slated to be knocked down.
Yeah.
So that's what's happening on the show. And also, yeah, I saw this that you, I was going to mention this as well, Hannah, that this evening at 5 p.m. there's obviously a protest against Pauline Hanson. They're announcing the launch of the One Nation election campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Believe this. I don't know if I heard it right at the rally yesterday for Palestine, but there's 88 candidates.
Damn.
For One Nation. I might be wrong. Let me look into that. But anyway, they're announcing an amount of candidates, which is obviously too many. And the protest, it's obviously really important to show your solidarity with marginalized communities who obviously face the brunt of this, particularly migrants and people of color. So the protest is happening this evening at 5 p.m. at Victoria Road Reserve next to Auburn Station in Hawthorne East.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do a little reminder later.
I'll be there.
Yeah, be there.
Better be there, guys. Let's show up. Should we get into our headlines?
Sure.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty now. One, two, nitty gritty now, yeah, boom. Nitty gritty, hoo-wee. Right down to the real nitty gritty.
These are the news headlines for Monday, the 3rd of August. More than 50,000 people swam 5 kilometres via the North African enclave of Ceuta from Morocco into Spain. Migrant Jadid Zakaria said, quote, "It was very tough. The police tried to stop us, but our will and determination allowed us to come here," end quote. In the last 2 days, around 18 people have died, some being from the length of the swim and the majority being from the stampede exiting the water. This is adding to the last few months where more than 50 people have died attempting to cross the border. Reports are still coming out about the amount of people who have passed. Far-right leaders across Europe has used this as a reason to boost restrictive laws and tougher powers to deny refugees from seeking asylum. In other news this week, most Australian states and territories have backed stronger national rules to ensure the rapid growth of data centres is powered by the new renewable energy rather than driving up electricity prices and climate pollution. Climate Council CEO Amanda McKenzie said, quote, "It's encouraging that almost every state and territory agrees that new data centres should be powered by additional renewable energy and that the Albanese government is moving to legislate. But without firm timeframes, these commitments risk falling short. Data centres are connecting to the grid rapidly and must be required to source new renewable power from day one." Amanda McKenzie criticised the Queensland and Northern Territory governments for refusing to support stronger national standards, saying that they had, quote, "put the interest of big tech and fossil fuel corporations ahead of Australian consumers," and, quote, "unless these governments get on board, Queenslanders and Territorians face higher power bills and all Australians will pay the price through increased climate pollution," end quote.
Finally, in the news this week, listeners, please be advised that this next headline mentions the death of a person in custody. If you feel it may cause distress, tune back in after a few minutes or call Lifeline at 131114 and 13 Yarn at 1392 76. An 18-year-old woman held at Dame Phyllis Frost Centre died in custody last week, Corrections Victoria has announced. The details of this person's death are not yet known. However, Corrections Victoria said in a pretty short media release talking about someone's death that the Coroner's Court of Victoria will investigate the cause. Flat Out, an independent community-based organisation advocating for and supporting women and gender diverse people who face the prison system, said of the death, quote, "We are devastated by this news. How does a young woman die in the quote-unquote care of the state?" End quote. The organisation continued by asking, quote, "Does her family and community now have to wait literally years for the inquest to find out why she died?" End quote. Flat Out also added that Victoria's crackdown on bail within the ARP government's tough on crime agenda has increased the number of women incarcerated at Dame Phyllis Frost Centre on remand, and that lockdowns, solitary, and a lack of adequate care has become rife in the prison. Some 426 women are incarcerated as of May this year in so-called Victoria, with only 226 sentenced. The news of this young woman's death comes as Victoria introduced legislation last week to limit prisoners' access to open air, which is currently only set to an hour per day. Such a move has required the Victorian government to override its own Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities. If this headline caused distress, please call Lifeline at 13 11 14 or 13 Yarn at 1392 76. These have been the news headlines for Monday the 3rd of August 2026. You're listening to 3CR Community Radio.
Hi, I'm Cam Smith from Yanar Pasaran.
I'm Andy Fleming.
Andy, quick question. The commercial media, that provides a voice to marginalised communities, doesn't it? And as governments around the world take a turn to the far right, it provides a critical anti-fascist analysis?
Cam, how many times do I have to tell you this? No, that's not the case.
Oh, that's not good. So who is doing all that?
Cam, community media, including 3CR, Melbourne's community radio.
And how can we support 3CR in doing that?
We can subscribe, Cam, at any time.
By visiting 3cr.org.au or calling the station on 9419 8377. Subscribe to 3CR.
And stay anti-fascist.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au. Trans Family is a not-for-profit organization providing a peer support group for loved ones, including parents, siblings, extended family, and friends of a trans and gender diverse person. Trans Family runs discussion groups in person and online. We offer a safe space to share your experiences, ask any questions regarding your situation, and provide peer support. We are especially keen to hear from loved ones in regional and rural Victoria. Donations to Trans Family are tax deductible. For more information, visit transfamily.org.au or look for us on Facebook. Trans Family is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here on 3CR Community Radio. That song before those announcements was Mantis by Courtney Barnett. We love Courtney Barnett on the Monday Breakfast Show.
We love her.
We are now going to listen to an interview, a two-part interview with the Seahorse Collective, who are an anonymous, autonomous collective of trans and gender diverse people supporting other trans and gender diverse people struggling to access gender affirming care. I just wanted to note before we play this interview that, as I said in the introduction, they are anonymous and wanted to retain their anonymity. Because of that, they have digitally transcribed their answers to the questions that we asked them in order to retain their privacy. So this first part talks about the collective itself and the struggles that trans and gender diverse people face in accessing gender affirming care across so-called Australia. And I'll say it again at the end of the interview, but if you or someone you know needs to contact the collective for help accessing for support with gender affirming care, you can email them at seahorsecollective@proton.me. Tell us about the Seahorse Collective and how it was formed.
In terms of who Seahorse Collective is, we are a collective of trans people who have lived experience struggling to access HRT, that is, hormone replacement therapy, like estrogen and testosterone that some trans people use to alter our bodies for people who aren't already aware. We are an anonymous collective, hence the strange voice you are hearing us through now, and we operate autonomously and independently. We aren't associated with any medical clinics or NGOs, any given political party, or the state. In terms of what Seahorse Collective does, we support people who are facing barriers to accessing HRT through formal healthcare institutions. Often that's people who can't access hormones at all through any formal channels that they've tried so far, such as through doctors' clinics. This can be people who've been kicked off hormones by their doctor, or who can't afford to see a doctor who's willing to prescribe hormones, as these doctors can be expensive. A lot of doctors who prescribe hormones also have waitlists that are just too long to be helpful, because often people are in urgent situations when they begin seeking hormone replacement for gender reasons. Long waitlists and prohibitively expensive or prejudiced doctors are systemic problems which stem from structural oppressions deeply rooted in this colony, but we'll talk more about this later. As a result of these violent and eugenic systems, a lot of us have been forced to, or prefer to, manage our hormones either without a doctor's involvement or not directly under their supervision. This is referred to as DIY HRT. Support from Seahorse Collective might look like knowledge sharing about the strengths and pitfalls of certain so-called trans-friendly doctors around town, advice about using hormones based on personal experience, or even assisting people to access hormones through whatever means are available to them. Anyway, to get in contact, email us at seahorsecollective@protonmail.com. We don't operate out of a physical space, nor do we have a website, so please do write that email down and email us if we can help you. seahorsecollective@protonmail.com. We can help no matter where you are on this continent. Seahorse Collective emerged in response to a specific political moment that we are still living in. In late 2024, the Queensland state government announced it was banning trans children from starting HRT or puberty blockers. By the way, this ban doesn't apply when adults decide an intersex child's sex needs to be supposedly corrected using the same interventions. And the federal government announced it was also reviewing trans healthcare for minors nationally. And obviously there's also this trend of putting trans healthcare under the culture wars microscope in all these Western liberal democracies, like the colonial powers of the UK and USA, which previously had this charming rainbow veneer claiming to protect queer people. At that moment in 2024, the broader trans movement, and self-appointed spokespeople like the cis parents of trans children, organized a national response demanding the Queensland state government quote-unquote return the control of trans healthcare back to the hands of doctors. This frustrated us because grassroots trans movements have never argued for trans healthcare to be controlled by doctors. Doctors have not been our allies any more than governments and politicians. There's a damaging power imbalance between doctors and patients. There's an intrinsic class dynamic between my doctor and me. It's not only that my doctor probably comes from a well-off background and is maintaining that background through her career, but to stay in that position she does need to convince me that she has more knowledge than me about my own body, and maintain power as the authority figure able to grant me medicines and offer me procedures. We are taught to believe we need doctors for every form of healthcare, but the self-evident fact is, everything we know about trans bodies comes from trans people. We find ourselves teaching our doctors things constantly. My doctor as a doctor doesn't know what it's like to be in my body, isn't there to take note of all the changes because even if my doctor is trans she isn't part of my community, as I am her patient. So when we heard trans and cis people calling for power in the hands of doctors not politicians, we were like, doctors, what about us? What about trans people's power when it comes to our own bodies? And, politicians? What about mobs' power when it comes to stolen land? For a long time, trans communities were defined by the ways we cared for each other because formal institutions rejected and harmed us. Many trans people never sought to be included in those institutions in the first place. Like them, we will continue caring for each other. And this is just as much the case for collectives who aren't necessarily trans. We are especially inspired by those communities struggling against imperialism and colonization for collective self-determination, you know, the Zapatistas' autonomous health services, the Young Lords' health program and actions in the Bronx, Auntie Alma Thorpe's vision for the Aboriginal Health Service, and the countless unrecorded Black, Brown, Indigenous and disabled communities who care for each other outside formal medical institutions. That federal review of trans healthcare for minors is due any day now, so we are curious to see what position the government takes. But ultimately we have no faith the colonial government can ever be a solution to trans people's problems. Nor can the colonial capitalist medical system in so-called Australia. After all, transphobia arrived on these shores in 1788, along with biological weapons of war, disease, sexually transmitted infections, medical racism. This is the same state that steals Aboriginal kids from their culture and community and locks them up at astounding rates, and we are supposed to believe this state suddenly cares about trans children? The only instance in which we observe this colony to care about trans people or trans children is when we are invited to take part in pinkwashing this whole colonial project. We reject that. Although our means are currently limited, we want to build something without the state, build our capacity for care of each other outside of the state, something that can't be taken away at a whim, something that helps build genuine bodily autonomy. And that's effectively how Seahorse Collective emerged, out of this frustration with the broader trans movement that's calling on this fundamentally illegitimate, deeply untrustworthy colony to quote-unquote help us. Acting like these institutions with so much power might just be a little bit kinder all of a sudden. Maybe instead, we could start judging institutional trans medicine, which is very much in the public eye at the moment, against DIY community healthcare practices, not the other way around.
Describe the current state of access to gender-affirming hormones for trans and gender-diverse people both here in so-called Victoria and across the continent.
Sure thing. And maybe our answer to this will explain a bit more for your listeners where our distrust in these institutions, which might seem really odd to some of you, comes from, and explain these abstract ideas a bit more. So just because we don't have a ban on HRT for minors in so-called Victoria, where Seahorse Collective is based, doesn't mean the trans healthcare situation here is good. People who are interstate, in an evidently worse situation regarding HRT, and also in a city, trans people who accessed hormones easily here, tend to assume that accessing hormones is easy in NAM and that's that. But the situation looks like this. Your typical GP, who has the power to prescribe and manage your hormones, will probably first say they can't prescribe you hormones or blockers because they don't know enough about trans healthcare, supposedly according to their principle of do no harm. Well, I can tell you now, the harm of being forced to go through a puberty you don't want, or denied hormones as an adult, is far greater than whatever marginal risks your transphobic doctor will summon out of thin air in order to deny you healthcare. Your typical GP might then thank you for your time and money and send you away with nothing, or, if you're lucky, refer you to one of the providers with supposed trans healthcare expertise, where you can rot on a waiting list for years or pay loads of money to get into one of the private ones more quickly. On the other hand, a friendly GP who isn't a quote-unquote expert on us might demand that you justify why you need hormones by explaining some mysterious deep inner feeling in your life story. Even then, you might not end up with a hormone prescription in your hand. In that doctor's room, you may face medical racism, fatphobia, and ableism, which persists even in supposedly progressive trans healthcare. A doctor won't allow you to start hormones if they perceive your natural hormone levels to be too high, but the medical standard for what is quote-unquote natural comes from cis non-intersex and white bodies. Trans mask people who are black, brown or indigenous can be denied or underprescribed testosterone because you are perceived to be already too masculine or have too much testosterone. Doctors might deny you hormones if you have diabetes, which obviously affects Aboriginal people's ability to access hormones because of the disproportionate rate of diabetes among Aboriginal people, another example of intersections of medical racism and cissexism. Medical fatphobia means that the doctor might assume it's too risky for you to begin hormones unless you lose weight, or they might falsely claim that you'll be at higher risk of cholesterol problems, heart attack, or blood clots than cis people. Medical fatphobia inflates perceived risks of HRT, centering around the idealized safety of thin white cis bodies, even though according to these standards, there's actually greater risks for people taking estrogen to manage menopause than for trans femmes on estrogen. Doctors may deny HRT to those of us deemed mad or mentally unwell until they consider us well enough to be granted bodily autonomy in accordance with medical ideas of personhood. And even then, we might be patronizingly put on a lower dose than we desire. Similarly, people with physical disabilities are also infantilized when seeking hormones, either by the doctor assuming it is too risky to start HRT, or that we cannot make our own medical decisions, as those in power control what choices we can make for ourselves, and why and when. These are just a few examples of how medical cissexism intersects with other systemic problems when we are dealing with doctors. Each have happened in this allegedly progressive, quote-unquote queer-friendly city. If the specialist GP does prescribe you HRT, they might make you see an expensive private endocrinologist and maybe psychologist first, and then put you on such a small starting dose that it's impossible to have any physiological effects. So it's as if you didn't even start HRT in the first place. But you've wasted all that time and money, not to mention the mental toll of constantly proving that you deserve this medicine, that you are mentally fit enough to decide to take it, that you can actually live for years as a real trans person. This is literally the process at one large specialized gender clinic that people in NAM are often referred to. So often we find ourselves educating the doctors about what to prescribe us, the side effects, how much we take and whatever else is relevant about our lives so we can get what we need out of the hands of these supposed experts. And when we come back into our communities with their advice, we learn it's based on flawed studies and misconceptions. This city is also known for having plenty of so-called trans-friendly private GPs compared to other capital cities. These GPs run on an informed consent model, meaning if you are 16 or over, the GP will ask you to read and sign a form outlining the effects and risks of HRT and then after a blood test give you a prescription on your second appointment with them. However, only a few of these doctors bulk bill, and every single one of them tends to have long waitlists because this supposedly special trans healthcare is only practiced by a few inner-city doctors. South Australia, in contrast, doesn't have a single informed consent GP taking patients. And if you're not covered by Medicare or the PBS because, for example, you're a refugee migrant or incarcerated, you're looking at massive bills to access healthcare. If you happen to be trans and incarcerated, probably in isolation specifically because you are trans, it is basically impossible to start hormones or even change your legal name for that matter. Even if you were on hormones before being incarcerated, this medical care along with much else is routinely denied to most people locked up by the state. If you are under 16, it's basically impossible to start hormones because legally you need both parents to fully support you, which is so rare even for adults. And if one parent doesn't sign off on it, you need to go to court, which is going to be expensive in itself. You need a supportive GP, but your family also needs to be able to afford the specialists. You need to pass ableist infantilizing cognitive tests, for the doctors to believe that you are actually trans like you say you are, and you need to be able to survive in this powerless limbo for years on waiting lists, with the constant threat of unwanted bodily changes, that is, puberty looming and taking shape. If you're in out-of-home care, forget about it. So all the hoops that have supposedly been eliminated for the most privileged trans people are still very much in place for people under 16. It might not be banned in Victoria, but the reality is that it might as well be for all but the most fortunate kids. So we see more and more people around us turning to DIY, not even because there aren't so-called gender-affirming doctors, but because doctors hold power over our bodies while we as a community are the ones who create, maintain, and live with the knowledge. Hopefully your listeners can see a bit now why we don't want our healthcare in the hands of doctors or politicians.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here on 3CR Community Radio. We are currently listening to an interview with the Seahorse Collective, who are an anonymous, autonomous collective of trans and gender diverse people supporting members of the trans and gender diverse community in accessing gender affirming care. We are going to keep going with this interview. The second part talks about how the Seahorse Collective fills the gap left by the colonial government in providing gender-affirming care. And again, I'll reiterate that because they're an anonymous collective, they have digitally transcribed their answers to retain their privacy. If you or someone you know needs to contact the collective for support in accessing gender-affirming care, you can email them at seahorsecollective@proton.me. Why is access to these medicines so important?
To push back a little bit, the reality is HRT isn't any more important to some trans people's lives than another medicine a person would need to function. The reason hormone replacement medicines are so central in trans narratives is because they are denied to us due to medical gatekeeping. Also because Western systems of sex and gender center around two hormones, which are biologically speaking relatively insignificant molecules. This is not to diminish the importance of HRT for many of us. These medicines can be life-saving and life-defining, as is the case with anything that, when restricted, constrains your very bodily autonomy. And we of course think whatever healthcare people need, they should have it. Gender, no matter what historical or social context happens to give it certain meanings and points of reference, is a social relation with material consequences. So when we talk about trans healthcare in a really concrete embodied way, the obvious questions are, do you have a safe place to live? Food to eat? Genuine safety and accountability beyond and against the state? A community that can determine its own destiny? A community that you transition with and within? We want to build our capacity as a movement to address these things. It is worth pointing out, especially to people who haven't transitioned, how much trans people's lives are defined primarily by our place in our communities, the solidarity we have with one another, the way we live our lives together. It is a symptom of the medicalization and exceptionalization of trans experience to see our transitions as individual inner journeys of triumph or tragedy, where the good gatekeeper, as a knowledge holder, sometimes chooses to hold the gate open, while the uninformed bad gatekeeper slams it in our faces. Collective struggles are viewed as, and then splinter into, individual journeys. But our transitions are part of the broader social and material collective struggles of our communities and ancestors. The reality is, for most people struggling to access HRT, this isn't even the primary problem in our lives. It instead compounds and overlaps with systemic issues we face around healthcare, bodily autonomy and self-determination, like the patriarchy, but perhaps more so also white supremacy, colonization and ableism. So I guess we want to push back on the tendency to exceptionalize trans experience, especially the privileged trans experience, away from other struggles.
How does this Seahorse Collective fill the gap left by the colonial government?
Yeah, this carries on nicely from what we were just saying because, if I can be a bit of a brat again, this gap that you refer to, we see it as intentional as opposed to just some blind spot by the colonial government. This extends to healthcare in general, especially for oppressed peoples. And we don't aim to fill it. We don't want to rehabilitate Australia or some Australian identity. It is easy to fall into this trap of believing in the rights we are supposedly owed because we are apparently Australians, or acting out this idea that many white queers implicitly hold, that they have lost some privileges of whiteness by transitioning and deserve to regain them. That is not the motivations of our collective, and we don't want to function on that presumption. Let's take filling the gap of state subsidies, like Medicare and the PBS. As we've mentioned, for trans people most doctors are so expensive and lots of procedures and drugs are too. But state-subsidized healthcare within a capitalist economy further entrenches the relationship between me and my doctor as an economic one and makes it more expensive. I am a consumer and the doctor a service provider. I am an individual with an individual problem and I pay for them to quote-unquote fix me, because they are apparently an expert on my problems. Our relationship is not founded on a horizontal understanding of each other, being in community together, having collective problems and solutions. It is an economic relationship that is perpetually bankrolled by the state. The state needs workers to be physically healthy enough to work for the economy to run, and therefore needs those people to be able to just afford some form of health care. So when doctors demand a certain higher standard of living, often beyond the communities they treat, they can do this because the state will keep begrudgingly paying the difference to keep subsidized health care just within reach for the working population. When doctors effectively strike for better wages by stopping bulk billing, refusing to be somewhat accessible to the majority of the population, are they striking in solidarity with us? We the consumers are only collateral in a strike meant to hit their employers, the state who pays most of their wages. As we've already said, there's an inherent class conflict between doctors and ourselves. And what about those people not covered by the state rebates? Refugees, incarcerated people, and the majority of migrants. The unsubsidized market cost of healthcare, doctors, and medicines keeps increasing for these populations the state doesn't find strategic to support. Healthcare becomes more and more inaccessible on the market. And who is actually subsidizing who? Isn't it the mob whose land has been stolen and mined to prop up the state's economy? And the refugees' homeland after being ravaged by an Aussie-backed imperialist war for more oil, or forcibly opening new markets for Aussie companies? We want to draw attention to how our healthcare, as crap as it can be, is dependent on the exploitation of others. We can't just ask for this system to be improved. And yet this image of the colony, as trans-friendly and progressive that we might be tempted to improve because there is some level of care and safety for the most privileged trans people, is paraded around by the colony, justifying our place in this imperialist world system as a force that will bring Western values and democracy to colonized and plundered backwards nations. Or going the other way, after plundering these nations, stoking conservatism and queerphobia in these besieged countries, this colony's portrayal of itself as a queer safe haven, the lucky country, allows it to call in migrants and refugees for a source of exploitable undervalued labor. To be clear, we are not calling for less public health care cover. Of course this helps countless people paying bills, nor are we suggesting we should stop fighting for queer life on this continent. But if this place continues to be stolen land, run by a capitalist white supremacist state with its hands across the globe, the problems will continue. Because colonization and capitalism is the root of the problem. If we zoom back in on trans people specifically, the individual battle a journey we were talking about before becomes real if we aren't actively resisting it. Because we are all so desperate to get into that doctor's office, to afford the appointment and all the meds and procedures, and subsequently so eager to give the state more power, to be its biggest ally. Because we are so desperate to believe the state will recognize, protect and care for us. That power and faith in the colony really means more oppression, especially for mob and less privileged trans people, and maybe even more privileged trans people when it's no longer politically expedient to the state to pretend to care. Many trans people cling onto the system in desperation to be model minorities, policing each other, our bodies and our political horizons. We do all this believing we will win the protection of the colony, that it is good to be on the side of the colony. And we lose sight of the solidarity we should have with one another, the community which, after all, is why we exist. We become dependent on these systems that can be, and are evoked at a moment's notice instead of building independent infrastructure that strengthens the self-determination of communities oppressed by the state. What if the depth of knowledge and care that our DIY community healthcare practices hold were measured against what we are officially told is the best service our doctors and the state can offer, not the other way around? We are so dependent on these colonial capitalist institutions, the state, and doctors, as the monopoly on healthcare. Yes, we can sometimes get what we need from them, but as a phrase we read recently goes, regardless of whether the gate is held open or closed, a gatekeeper is still a gatekeeper. Instead of filling this intentional gap by the colonial state, we want to be able to take away power from it, building alternative communities and infrastructure against it, even if we are using what we can take from it when we can. Girls have been sharing hormones or stealing them from their mothers, forever, and oppressed communities have been fighting against their oppressors forever too. We are just one very small, though visible, part of a much larger struggle. And unlike state-backed alternatives, Seahorse Collective won't make you explain yourself if you don't want to. There are no criteria you need to fulfill for us to help you. We aren't going to charge you.
And so, finally, what does trans liberation look like to you all?
Oh my God, that is such a big question. One that we don't have all the answers for, nor should we. Trans liberation would look like the strongest community you can imagine. It would be a commitment to holding each other, including non-queer people. And it'll mean new social relations beyond the colonial Western system planted on this continent only 250 years ago. Trans liberation requires bodily autonomy through free on-demand access to any form of medical care, be it gender-affirming, reproductive, sexual or surgical, without being gatekept by doctors or the state. Prison and psychiatric abolition, decriminalization of sex work and drug use. These are things that should be put in place ASAP, but we need to recognize the ways these demands are often imagined within a colonial and or imperialist world that presumes extractive supply chains and imperial rent are natural and inevitable. Because really the first step for trans liberation on this continent is the return of land to, and sovereignty for, every Aboriginal nation. Whose liberation are we talking about if this continent remains stolen land? True bodily autonomy doesn't exist under occupation. We need to fight for self-determination and national liberation on this continent and internationally if we want liberation, trans, or otherwise. People talk about Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson but forget that they weren't just criticizing the white cis middle-class gays for their transphobia. Sylvia and Marsha insisted that the queer movement must be in solidarity with oppressed nations as part of a larger revolutionary anti-imperialist struggle. They are big words and concepts that we've tried to explain a little in our previous answers, but think about this. Trans people are always rightfully worried that our access to care is going to be revoked at any moment, but as sovereign mob teach us, the LORE of the country you are on cannot be subverted or changed at the whims of political opportunity. Is that not a clear indication that trans liberation cannot be achieved without land back? On a final note, we always get people asking how they can help out, to which we respond, start a formal or informal autonomous trans healthcare collective in your community. There are plenty of resources online. Go out and fight colonialism, imperialism, and fascism. But if you want to help us out specifically, we will send 3CRR sticker and poster designs that you can download and paste around, or email us at seahorsecollective@protonmail.com and we can mail you some. Thanks for having us Monday Breakfast.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here on 3CR Community Radio. It is 46 minutes past 7 in the morning. We just heard the second part of an interview that we have done with the Seahorse Collective, who are an anonymous and autonomous collective of trans and gender diverse people supporting people in the community to access gender affirming care. As I said before, apologies if the digital voice was a little bit jarring on the radio. The collective digitally transcribed their answers to the questions that we asked them in order to retain their privacy. So we were obviously talking about the collective itself, the struggles that trans and gender diverse people face in accessing gender affirming care in this continent, as well as trans liberation in general. Again, as they said at the end of the interview, if you or someone you know needs to contact the collective, you can email them at seahorsecollective@proton.com. And yeah, we'll put a little poster in the podcast notes for the show after it finishes. Stay tuned.
3CR, your station, your voice.
Do a bit of disrupting and cause a bit of ruckus in the colony.
Always was, always will be.
Not celebrate Australia, but instead pay homage to the resistance of First Nations people against this illegal colonial occupation.
This country's black future is a fire. It's the right season. That burning school fire.
Every form of discrimination that exists in our community is magnified and utilised by prisons to cause greater division and disarm solidarity.
We've got to really put a lens of perspective on this and know that there are children being incarcerated as young as 10 years old.
Police and prisons, they're doing exactly what this colony wants them to.
Who do we defend?
Police!
And who else? Prisons, pull them down!
Yay! 3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
CR, always bringing you the latest union news.
They're coming after us at the moment. They want to get rid of penalty rates, the big push from businesses. They want to get rid of all the things that you and I have fought for.
So there's tens of thousands of jobs gone, contracted out to sham contracting arrangements.
On 8:55 a.m. and on the web, 3cr.org.au.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio at 5:05 a.m. We're now going to listen to an excerpt of an interview from the Billabong Beach Show from Tuesday the 21st of July, in which host Gavin Moore speaks with Marilyn and Peter from the Friends of the Naya Vinifera Park campaign. They're talking about water projects and water sovereignty in the Murray River. This first part talks about the organisation itself and gives context to the campaign.
Now, I'm talking to you guys about an occupation or a protest that's been going on at the Naya Vinifera Forest. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. It's more of a friendly discussion kind of atmosphere that we've created to, I guess, to share more knowledge about what's going on with water and water on country and our Murray River, and how sometimes a lot of public people are sometimes smoke screened and don't understand it.
Yeah.
So it's been a great experience of 50 days of a continued fire and conversations with locals and other First Nation peoples that come and have a chat so we can inform them more about what's happening.
Yes, it's a pretty good effort there, 50 days or something like that.
And yes.
Could you tell us what's happening and who's putting these pipelines through the country there?
Well, I might let Peter talk about that because Peter and I know each other well and we've been on this journey with Friends of the Forest for well over 35 years.
Yeah.
So, Peter, if that's all right?
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, I can talk a little bit about that. So what the government's now calling the Victorian Murray Floodplain Restoration Project has two sites, two specific projects, in one in Nyre Forest and one in Vernifera Forest. It's a project that's been designed and implemented by the Victorian government with Lower Murray Water at the head, but it's been funded through the federal government's Murray-Darling Basin Plan. Now, we've advocated strongly over the years for the Murray-Darling Basin Plan and are strong supporters of environmental water. But unfortunately, this is one part of the plan that we really, really don't agree on and have been advocating for some major changes to the project, or just to go even come right back to the drawing board with the community and look at alternatives, of which we reckon there's a few really good alternatives that are going to have better environmental outcomes for our river system and our river country, and also be cheaper for the taxpayer as well. So, yeah, this camp that we've got down there for community at Vernifera Forest, it's an amazing little thing that's happened in the community, and it's given people a place to go, a place to share information, celebrate the forest and the river country as it is, and also, stand up and say, show the community, oh, there's a different way of looking at things at this project, and some of us passionately disagree that it's the right way to go.
Yeah, I think that the handling of the land or land management is pretty poor in this country. They don't have any appreciation for Aboriginal engineering, burning and water control and so forth. I understand they're putting pipelines through the forest there, moving water around. Is that correct?
So what's planned in both Nyre and Vernifera, they're quite similar projects in that large containment banks, or what some people would probably recognise as a levee bank, of different heights are being separating out the top ends of both of the reserves, and the idea is that the government wants to be able to manipulate environmental water, pump it in to the forest and hold it there for different amounts of time rather than having that sort of natural connected flow that we would prefer to see.
Is that for the benefit of the farmers? Or?
Absolutely. In many ways it is. It's certainly, whilst it's being called a restoration project, both of them actually mean there's going to be less water for the environment. So 2.5 gigalitres of water recovery for the basin plan will be avoided if these two projects go ahead. So right there at the onset, there's actually a negative impact in the sense that there's less water for the environment if these two projects go ahead. Aside from the containment banks, you've also got large regulators where you've got a beautiful natural and cultural landscape that's been shaped, I guess is how I would, and I won't speak about this in detail, but it's been shaped over thousands of years. What they want to do is put large regulators and other infrastructure in to manage the water, and it just sort of feels as though our natural landscape's being industrialised, and it's really quite an unnatural way to manage the water system, in my belief, and I'd love to hear Marilyn's thoughts on that too.
Yes, thanks, Pete. We kind of flip and try to understand each other. me being a First Nations Aboriginal woman living right on the Murray River at a place called Woodwood, which is close to the Robinvale and Swanhill area on Wadi Wadi country, and being a woman from Wadi Wadi connections and Lachi Lachi and many other Tshishwana groups. It's always been our right to, since children, to understand the river and to watch the water rise and fall and to know how it moves across country in its most natural state. So we've been trained in that water watch from day one as First Nations people. And to see what's been happening to our Murray River, which we say is, the language word is Malu, where I live, and I must say too that I'm also a taxpayer and a ratepayer. So my money goes towards these government projects, which I'm not happy with, and I'm not happy with the way that they're implementing these structures to change our cultural aspect of the river and how it relates to us, including the floodplains. Along those riverways are a lot of our heritage sites where our people walked and moved across country during seasons for thousands of years, and our evidence is based upon our heritage sites within that forest area of the floodplains as well. So one of the things that we've been worried about is that they haven't yet proven to us through their science approach that our ancestors that we were repatriated back into their resting places in that area, in that floodplain area, are not going to be flooded for the wrong time of the year and sitting in water. So I'm concerned about the cultural heritage management plans sign-off by government who don't know our water spaces and have no connection to how we fully understand the spirit of water on country and our land and how we see it as people. There's always that wedge gap of thinking and misinterpreting wording, so it's not saying what we really feel and understand. So we're a bit peeved off with government and the government water bodies and the landowners. It seems like it's their monopoly on how they'd like to manoeuvre and control, as usual, the same words as Terrinalis and Aquinalis. The effects are the same. It might look a little bit different, but it is exactly that. And the impacts, it still scars upon certain people like myself who have that connection. So for me, it's about our people understanding more what's going on with water on country, what's going on with the rivers that we grew up with, what's going on with our cultural heritage around these spots, and not to pocket it into silos that it's all looks like a piece of a jigsaw puzzle that one sits there, and then it's a surprise to us all about, jeepers, what's happened to our country? This is how they've ruined it. It's too late then. So we need to really get with it and understand and have a proper say along this waterway, along the Murray Rivers and any other rivers, what's going on? What is really going on? Because those two things, Terrinalis and Aquinalis, they're well and truly still alive today.
Do you think that Aboriginal people's involvement with the Murray-Darling Basin do you think it's been a bit tokenistic?
From my point of view, Gavin, we thought they were going to help us more to achieve our cultural values and beliefs around water and our country. But it's government-driven and it's still a tokenistic process.
Do we know how much these pipelines are costing to put in? And have they been put anywhere else before?
They have been. They're trying to scrape the what's left of water on country and tunnel it down the Murray River so it goes to those particular irrigators. So Nyah Vinifera Woodwood Forest, what is now termed as a park, it's only one example where the government bodies are actually doing these KPIs on their achievement.
What's the KPI? What's the KPI?
The key priority areas, including think goals that they want to achieve and not what we want to achieve as First Nations people.
It takes me back to the 1949 Genocide Convention Act. In which Australia was given several different opportunities, I suppose. One was to treaty with the Aboriginal peoples and do the right thing. I don't know what the other one was. But the third option was to continue the path that they're to fundamentally alter the environment in every aspect.
Yeah.
And so that's what they're doing.
Commercialise it and...
And they're changing it and they're putting all these new trees and animals in, and the Aboriginal people can't recognise it anymore. And I think that's how they disenfranchise us from the land. And
it's exactly that, Gavin. And it's a form of disconnecting us from the country we know and our ancestors knew, and it's not right. It's totally not right.
I think as Aboriginal people, we have a more personal experience in terms of the land, that like lakes and rivers and things like are living living entities, you know. And I just think that these pipelines they're putting in, it sounds like they're putting stents into the body.
Exactly that, Gavin. It's an invasive process.
Yeah.
And it's an implementation of government, and to put the fear in people about climate change, which is the big umbrella that covers it all, to enforce us to thinking that there is a risk, there'll be no water. But I'm concerned about these greedy ones that want all this water, that have manipulated the water market and the government bodies.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Arnica Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here on 3CR Community Radio. That was an excerpt of Billabong Beats interview from the 21st of July, in which the host, Gavin Moore, was speaking with Marilyn and Peter from the Friends of Naya Vinifera Park campaign, talking about water projects and the threat to the Murray River and the Naya Vinifera Park itself. We'll put a link to the petition and to the organisation's Facebook page so folks can find out more information in our podcast notes. Now we're joined live in the studio by Debbie, who's a public housing resident and member of 44 Flats United, who's a community organisation working against the Victorian government's plans to demolish all of the state's 44 public housing towers. Good morning, Debbie.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for coming in to join us so bright and early and cold on this Monday morning. Maybe you'd like to start by telling us about the action that 44 Flats United has planned for Wednesday.
So Wednesday the 5th of August at 1 p.m. we are taking our petitions to Ministry Housing. If anyone would like to come along, feel free to do so.
Mm-hmm. And obviously it's at 1 p.m. at 1 Spring Street. outside. Correct. Yeah. So tell us about the petitions.
It's so we don't be removed from our homes.
Yeah. Yeah. So
and there are a lot of elderly in the building. Nobody wants to move. They all want to stay. Why they've done this to the elderly has got me beat.
Mm. So as a public housing resident, how have you found the Victorian, like, what has your experience been like living in the public housing towers while Victorian government is actively pursuing to push people out of their own homes?
Well, I think it's very disgusting. It's a lot of it is to do with mental health, with a lot of the elderly living in the building. They're confused. They don't know where to go, what to do. We've approached them in a nice way, and now they're all starting to come to the party because they're understanding where we're coming from. We need to keep this petition going and approach the Minister of Housing.
Mm. And we can put a little link to the petition in the podcast that we publish after the show for folks to sign. How long have you been in public housing?
Well, my dad's been there for 29 years.
Yeah.
I've just recently moved in with my dad in a one bedroom due to the fact of having a massive heart attack back in January this year. So, yeah. And the way everybody was notified, they weren't. It was all on social media. Nobody was told in a letter or face-to-face.
That they were being forced from their homes?
Yep.
Right. And for especially this third tranche, the third set of demolitions, right, is for all seven, these seven buildings that all contain people over the age of 55, right? And they're notifying people over social media.
That's how a lot of people have found out.
Mm.
So they're pushing for everyone to get out. The building we're in at Flemington, they reckon it needs to be demolished due to the fact of mould and asbestos, and there's nothing wrong with our building, nothing whatsoever. We've had no issues, apart from bed bugs and, you know, cockroaches. But hey, that needs a good clean-up.
So tell us about the response to that. Like, have you... Obviously, the housing ministry is aware that there are bed bugs and cockroaches.
Yes, well, we've had ours treated more than once, and now we're onto the bed bugs, which ours is a very clean flat, and it's gone through our brand new furniture, our brand new couch.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's all we want is it to be cleaned up and fumigated the whole flats.
It's not really that much to ask for, that you have a nice, clean home to live in.
That's right. And there's others that just don't like cleanliness.
So how widespread is the bed bug situation in Flemington?
Pretty bad.
Yeah.
Pretty bad. But we get on top of ours straight away. But, I mean, there's been people there that have complained about it, bed bugs, and they just ignore the situation. But then we do the threat of a current affair. And that's it. Then finally something gets done.
So how has 44 Flats United's experience been in sort of reaching out to more mainstream media about this issue?
They have been excellent. They are wonderful. They've helped us a lot. They've helped us cope through everything that's been going on about the move. So they're wanting everybody to stay. Everybody's happy with that.
Mm.
So rather than push us out, they're sticking by us.
Mm. And of course, I mean, you were saying off air that so many of the residents in Flemington want to stay, right?
That's correct. That's correct. A lot want to stay. A lot have moved because they think once they find a place, it's time they have to go. But we've all got 2 years to move out. We've got until 2028.
Mm. And I guess at any age, particularly being over 55, the toll of having, like, knowing this move is coming, that would have been a lot, right?
It's a lot. it is a lot. And, you know, a lot of them are non-speaking English people,
mm-hmm.
so they're confused as well.
So and they just... So, like, has the Ministry of Housing sort of provided translation or anything of that nature to help people understand the situation?
No. Not that I'm aware of.
Right.
Because I stay away from Homes Victoria.
Yeah, fair enough.
I have nothing to do with them. They're pushy, 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 but they're not helping us at all. They're not helping anyone.
Mm. Yeah, right. So, like, how long has it taken to get this bug situation attended to? I mean, I know a few weeks ago we spoke with Tom, who lives at the Inkerman Street flats in St. Kilda, was saying it had taken quite a while for their bed bug situation to be addressed. And I think it was only because of community pressure that it actually was.
Well, I'm actually going into housing today to discuss this with our officer.
Right.
Because, and we reckon that the one that is actually doing the spraying, we reckon he's diluting it very badly, because once you spray, it should kill everything, but it hasn't been.
Especially for multiple occurrences of bed bugs over a pretty short period, right?
Yep.
Wow. Yes, so obviously you're...
So you said your dad has lived in these towers for 25 years, was it?
29 years.
29 years.
And he's 84.
Wow. And how's he feeling about everything that's happening, and how has it been speaking to people about their experiences as well?
Well, he doesn't really communicate with anybody. Mm. That's why I've jumped on board.
Mm.
He can't read, he can't write. He's just doesn't know what's going on. He's confused.
Mm.
But I said to him, I'll jump on board and I'll go on the committee and just leave it with me. I'll deal with it all.
That's good.
And that's what we've done with the rest of the... I mean, 12 floors. He's on the 12th floor. He's light. He loves it. He loves the view.
Mm.
You know, he's the only one that keeps it painted and looked after. The others just, some of them are that old that they can't do anything anyway.
Mm.
So, yeah, it is hard. It's hard. But he was notified while he was in rehab after having the heart attack and the stroke back in January. So it's hard for him to cope with, but we've all got to stand by him.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now he's just found out he's got more cancer, so, yeah, he's got enough to deal with.
Yeah. And you said that you spoke to a few other older residents to help bring them into the 44 Flats United campaign, and you said that they responded well. Can you tell me more about, like, what happened and how it went, speaking to older people?
Well, we've explained it properly to all the residents.
Mm-hmm.
So they understand exactly what's happening now. Don't rush to move out because Homes Victoria want you to go. We want to stay. We're going to fight this, and nobody's going to tell us otherwise.
Yeah.
We're going to fight the fight, and it's called stick together as one.
Absolutely. Yeah, is there anything else you wanted to add before we let you go? Thank you so much for coming in.
Okay.
We'll just remind our listeners that, 44 Flats United have organised an action for this Wednesday, the 5th of August, at 1 p.m. outside the Housing Minister's office in the CBD at 1 Spring Street in Melbourne. And, we'll include the petition that 44 Flats United have created to work against this disgusting campaign to force residents out of their own homes.
Well, what they need to do is come and see the homes. Don't just say you're going to demolish. Come and see the what's damaged and what's not damaged, you know. Don't just say we're going to pull it down.
Mm. Absolutely.
Because we're only in a little street and there's all houses across the road. I mean, what are they going to do? Got to get a big crane in We've got the horse stables right next door to us. That's going to upset a lot of people. So good luck. Good luck, in my opinion.
Yeah, and stick together.
Fight the fight.
Fight the fight. Absolutely. Anyway,
fight the fight.
Stay tuned.
The state Labor government has begun works on demolishing Melbourne's 44 public housing towers to be replaced with private housing. Already, hundreds of residents have been displaced, often into unsuitable homes under duress.
The towers on Racecourse Road, Flemington, have become Homes Victoria work sites, while the families still living in the buildings are being treated appallingly.
Join Save Public Housing supporters in solidarity with residents.
Weekdays 7:30 till 9 a.m. as we engage with passing traffic to make some noise and show Jacinta Allen
that the demolition of public housing is unacceptable. Signs and banners provided or bring your own.
There's power in numbers, so see you at 120 Racecourse Road, Flemington, 7:30 till 9 a.m.
Save Public Housing is a 3CR supporter.
Join public housing residents fighting to save their homes from demolition. Residents from across NAM are demanding to meet Housing Minister to hand deliver a petition to save the high rises they have called home for decades. Join us outside Nick Starkos's office, 1 Spring Street, Wednesday the 5th of August, 12:30 p.m. to hear directly from the residents. Show them we support their struggle. Nick Starkos's office, 1 Spring Street, Wednesday the 5th of August, 12:30 p.m. Follow 44 Houses United on Instagram for updates. 44 Flats United is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the Apartheid Free Zone movement.
Help 3CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a Container Deposit Scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass, or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.org.au for more information.
Deal really accentuates and is very complementary to the White Australia domestic policy. Here you have not only a white alliance, but an Anglo-Saxon alliance of the ultimate cultural allies of the United States banding together, and the significance that it is aimed at colored peoples, at Asian peoples, at Pacific peoples. This is injecting a horrible racial dimension to this conflict. So I think the US and Australian elites' racist military policies are complementing the increasingly racist domestic policies. So I think, therefore, we really have to look out very, very carefully at this very dangerous synergy between racism on the military front and racism on the domestic front.
Subscribe to 3CR Where else can you hear radical news, analysis, music and opinions? Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 03 9419 8377.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. Before those community service announcements, we were just joined by Debbie from 44 Flats United, who is a resident of the public housing towers in Flemington. We're going to finish off the show by bringing you the second part of the interview from Billabong Beats, which was from the 21st of July, where host Gavin Moore spoke with Marilyn and Peter from Friends of Naya Vinifera Park campaign, where they speak about water projects and water sovereignty in the Murray River. This part speaks about the government's neglect of the Murray River and the lack of consultation with both First Nations people and the community in the area about the development of the Murray River.
My understanding is that most of the water goes to these cotton growers.
Exactly that.
In the northern part of the Murray-Darling Basin.
I'd love to add something to that conversation, if we've got a little bit more time, Gav.
Yeah, sure, we've got plenty of time for you guys, no worries. Yeah.
I mean, firstly, I want to go back and acknowledge that I'm lucky enough to be out here at the Vinifera Forest right now in Wadi Wadi country, and I want to definitely acknowledge that and acknowledge the Wadi Wadi Nation and pay my respect. But I will say too that regarding the science of these projects, that's the sad part of that about it, that they're being called restoration projects. But you know, the independent peer reviewed research does not suggest that this is the best way to restore a river system. And certainly, I would concur with you, Marilyn, that this Murray Darling Basin plan and its the aspirations, I think all people, all of our country had greater aspirations for what would be achieved under the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, and certainly for First Nations people still only own a tiny, tiny percent of the water that has been marketised and commercialised in this country. And it's a terrible disposition, and I'm very, very sorry that's the case, that it's still happening.
It seems like they won't even come up with the minimal for us, you know?
Yeah, right now, amazingly, we've got this flow coming down, a natural flow coming down the river from a high rainfall event in the upper catchment, which is giving us a great opportunity to demonstrate exactly the sort of preference we have for water coming onto the floodplain up here in the Mid-Murray and on Wadi Wadi country, and so that needs to be managed in a more natural way, just like it is here coming onto our floodplains and the Billabong through the Vinifera Forest right at the moment is teeming with life. If we could only use environmental water to top that up, which we currently cannot do, they're preferring to go on a drip feed sort of life support sort of principle, where they're drip feeding little sites here and there rather than using a connected flow. And it's just a sad situation where it's being dressed up as a restoration when there's a far better alternative out there. And a better alternative would, of course, genuinely, and from the very, very beginning of the process, involve First Nations people.
I think that these Murray Darling Basin and the state government are environmental vandals. They're eco-genocidists. They seem to be intent on destroying the land. They drive it like they stole it. You know, and it's disgusting to see the destruction of these places, particularly. I heard you say earlier, Maron, that some Aboriginal sites of significance were going to be disturbed or destroyed. Is that?
Well, it's one of those things that they're trying to sit us on the edge of a. We'll look after the cultural heritage stuff. We'll let you know if we come across anything. They make sure they've got enough money in the budget to pay for heritage work. And they know very well that our mob need that money.
you know, because we live on the pauper line.
You know,
no matter what heritage, you go. Yeah, so our heritage is always still at risk, and we've got to always be on one with them and watching them all the time, what they're doing, not fully trust. No one can look after our heritage better than us.
And it's not happening that way. Heritage is another word for inheritance. And so what's happening is our inheritance is being managed by the non-Aboriginal peoples who don't really fully understand or know what, because they don't appreciate the Aboriginal engineering of water and fire and all these other things that kept the place balanced and it just seems like they're destructing these forests and putting these water pipes through for I don't know why, what their good reason is.
Yes, exactly that, Gavin. So for me, it's not okay for me to see concrete and metal structures within this landscape, this floodplain landscape.
Now you guys down there at the Vinifera and Nye Forest have these unique mounds have been made because it's a Murray Red Gum flood plain, isn't it?
Yes, it is. The other thing about it, Gavin, is that they've locked the gates on us from doing our usual stuff. And me especially, I always check the forest and our heritage site. It's just a regular thing we do weekly, and I do weekly. But now they've put the gates up and put the padlocks and the cameras up on these big pedestal things. I can't access the roadways now to go and check our heritage site. Well,
might be time to do some backburning, perhaps. Might be time to do some backburning, maybe, you know.
The thing is, too, most of us look upon these special places. I mean, just less than 20 years ago, they were declared as significant regional parks rather than the state forests that they'd been managed for a long time. But most of us, and including like a lot of the locals around here who aren't First Nations people, they see it as a whole landscape, not individual sites that are dotted that, you know, you can put a fence around and protect. This landscape is supposed to be protected in a reserve. And so why can you go and clear up to 27 hectares to put in, levees and containment banks to flood a site that's always flooded and still is. It's flooded here right now today. One of the beautiful things about our camp and the sad reality that this project is, you know, coming closer to being constructed is that it's given community an opportunity to learn more and actually voice their opposition, because you do not meet a person in this community that is all for it. Most people don't know about it. Those that do don't understand it. And the ones that understand it don't support it.
Mm. It's been interesting, Gavin, with the fire burning, how many local community people from the local towns have actually brought wood to the fire to burn, for us to burn and keep the fire going. And how many have actually come down to bring a bag of potatoes or a cooked soup or to share. So their interest is, and their stories are connected to with the forest. So it's not just me as a First Nations person and some of our other First Nations mob that have got stories. There's a lot of locals that this forest is theirs as well.
Sounds like
and they don't want to see the changes.
It sounds like the state government and the Murray-Darling Basin committee.
They need to come back to community, Gav. They need to come back.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. That was a second part of an interview from the Billabong Beach Show on the 21st of July, in which host Gavin Moore speaks with Marilyn and Peter from the Friends of Nye Vinifera Park. campaign about the blockade they have going on and water sovereignty. We'll put the link to both the campaign's Facebook page and also their petition that they've set up for the blockade in our podcast notes. Of course, you can listen to Billabong Beats live every Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. And also check out previous episodes on the 3CR website. We've only got a few moments left of the Monday Breakfast Show for this week, so I'll also just remind you that we also spoke with Debbie, who's a public housing resident and member of 44 Flats United, talking about the group's upcoming action on Wednesday the 5th of August at 1 p.m. outside the Housing Minister's office on 1 Spring Street. And we also spoke with the Seahorse Collective about gender-affirming care here in so-called Australia and trans liberation. And just a last reminder that there will be a protest this evening at 5 p.m. against One Nation's launch of their Victorian election campaign at 5 p.m. at the Victoria Road Reserve next to Auburn Station in Hawthorne East. Please show up for the community and against fascism. We'll see you next week.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.